Good afternoon. My name is Knut Rostad. I'm a founder and the president of the Institute for the Fiduciary Standard. On behalf of the Institute, thank you all for joining the call today. The Institute is pleased to host today's call, one of several events that are part of what we call Fiduciary September. The Institute established Fiduciary September in 2012 to further the mission to advance an understanding of the vital role of fiduciary principles in investment and financial advice. The idea is simply to set aside a month to provide a series of educational events to underscore why fiduciary principles matter. The Institute's partner in Fiduciary September 2014 is TD Ameritrade Institutional and is the sponsor for our events this month. Today we will discuss fiduciary best practices, what are they, and why we need them. On the panel, we have Chris Cannon of First Trust Investment and Financial Advisors and a member of the Institute's Best Practices Board, Blaine Aiken of FI360, and James Walsh, a securities attorney and prolific writer on fiduciary issues. We hope you will not only find the discussion informative and useful, but that you will help raise awareness among investors and advisors at this critical topic in your ensuing conversations, coverage, and articles. For more information on the Fiduciary September events, please visit the Institute's website at www.thefiduciaryinstitute.org. Upcoming highlights include a live discussion with best practices board members this Monday at 4:30, and the Frankel Fiduciary Prize Symposium and Award Ceremony on September 19th at Columbia University Law School, which will honor former CFTC Chair Gary Gensler and feature, among other speakers, former SEC Chair Arthur Levitt. We will begin today with Chris Cannon discussing key historic background to the issue of best practices. Then I will discuss a white paper the Institute just released today. It's called Key Principles for Fiduciary Best Practices and an Emerging Profession. Blaine will follow with a discussion of FI360 prudent practices. And then James will hit cleanup and complete opening remarks, offering his observations as a practicing attorney in the field. Each speaker will speak up to 6 or 7. We will then go into Q&A. Please email me your questions at kar@rpjadvisors.com, and then we'll keep the conversation going. So with that brief introduction, Chris, please begin.
Thanks, Knut. I just wanted to say a few words about the historical framework around the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. What were the circumstances at the time? What was the thinking about it in its genesis? And what does that mean today, and how have things changed? So the important factor that I think is largely missing from today's dialogue around all of these issues involves why the Investment Company of 40 Act came to be in the first place. To oversimplify it, it was essentially an offshoot of a report that Congress took on in 1935, and essentially what it was part of trying to deal with what had happened during the stock market crash of 29, the ensuing depression, and what were some of the root causes of it. And interestingly, and maybe not surprisingly, it was the view that there were lots of tipsters and participants in the marketplace that were out there willy-nilly saying all kinds of things and no real way of knowing what was marketing materials, what was real thought, and where was it coming from, who was doing it, that sort of thing. So it came to be as a result of trying to define, well, who is providing real advice and who may be just trying to manipulate some sort of an asset price. And it was also largely conceived of as a principles-based system as opposed to a rules-based system that I think dominates our regulatory environment today. So it was all about doing the right thing for the client and the public knowing and there being disclosure rules and that sort of thing. So I think it's interesting to note that it was created to make a clear and definitive line between what is a sales practice and who are people that are selling securities and packaging them and people who are offering advice. and that's where it comes from. And I think that, again, that's been kind of muddled up, particularly over the past decade. The reason I bring it up in this context is that I feel like it was about defining lanes, you know, who is doing what, and I think that maybe to reshaping the understanding and debate about how we got here involves thinking about how clearly sales practices saw what was working and in many ways and what sells. And the lane started to drift further and further over from sales into the advice arena, and more things were being used that looked like advice on the sales side. And I think that that's how we've gotten to where we are now. And I think that it's important to have a return of understanding about why things were the way they were, how it's in many ways gotten back to the same issues that needed clarification originally, and perhaps, without sounding too much like someone who advocates founder's intent, going back and saying, well, what is it that we have forgotten, or what can we learn again? So I think that focusing on that history and maybe what we've gotten here by the sales practices drifting into the advice lane as opposed to maybe Venn diagramming it and saying there's lots of crossover. So the reason that I am so passionate about this particular issue is that I feel like the debate has changed and it's focused more on, well, how do we make the salespeople who are effectively giving advice and the public sees them as giving advice, how do we make them compliant? And I think that one of the things to look at here is to go back and understand the context of how it was all created, and again, maybe returning to some of those core principles, and not necessarily in just a rules-based framework, but also in the principles-based framework of being a fiduciary. Thanks, Kanu.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you for your opening remarks. Okay, I will continue in the opening remarks by highlighting a little bit of what is in the paper that has just been released today, Key Principles for Fiduciary Best Practices and Emerging Profession. But before I go into the paper, I just want to mention about three things in terms of what it was that we saw in the marketplace that really prompted this paper and this effort. And the first, I guess the first thing is really what Chris talked about in terms of the increasingly dim and hard to detect line between sales and advice that was a key reason for the Advisors Act and dealing with the problems that were believed to have been a major cause of the run-up to the crash in the 1920s. So first item is the issue of separating sales from advice. This second item that I think is very present in the marketplace is the degree to which investors have misconceptions about what it is that brokers do, what it is that advisors do, what their services are, and what it is that they pay for their services and total fees and expenses. I don't know that there's any question that there are huge misconceptions out there. I think the research is pretty clear on that. And I think another part of the research is that those misconceptions are harmful to investors in terms of the decisions that they are making out there. I think that's also a piece of it. And then another piece of it that we see is the level of investor distrust of financial services generally, of financial institutions, and I think increasingly evidence that some of this distrust is seeping into their views of financial and investment advisors, and so that it is part of our space in the financial advisory industry, and it's not just part of the larger picture alone. So those are some of the things that we see in terms of the larger picture that sort of prompted this initiative. And then as we got closer to the situation, so to speak, and we looked at what the regulators are doing and emphasizing, and looked at what some of the other groups are doing and emphasizing, one of the things that we saw was there was a unevenness between and the emphasis that's placed on technical issues regarding investment financial advisor practices, technical skills, experience, accreditations that are most reflected in the issue of or the duty of due care on the one hand, as opposed to the ethical issues that are important for anybody providing advice, i.e., we saw a far greater emphasis on the technical side of criteria and competence as opposed to the ethical side. And then going down more deeply, more specifically, looking at what's out there and seeing that there needs to be far greater emphasis on sort of three general areas that encompass or express, I think, the ethical side. The first one being conflicts of interest. The second one being the reasonableness and transparency of fees and expenses, and the third piece being communications that are clear, complete, and truthful. And that looking at these three topic areas. And then seeing what sorts of premises and principles should be the basis for best practices going forward. And so in the area of conflicts of interest, for example, we identify several points. And let me say that these points in and of themselves may come across as being obvious. They may come across as being non-controversial, and they may come across as being sort of blatant that you can ask, well, why do they need to be identified at all? I think that's a good question, which I'll get to as I sort of finish my remarks. But in the area of conflicts of interest, for example. Starting with just the simple idea that objectivity is essential as a principle or premise, and then moving down and suggesting that conflicts are bad, they can gut objectivity as a second bullet point, and then as a third bullet point, for example, neutralizing conflicts is needed. Again, these seem like obvious points, but I think part of the problem is that in the broader picture, in terms of practices that are out there now, they are not stressed nearly enough, and that is a source of some of the problems that we have right now. So that's the topic of conflicts of interest. Looking on in terms of reasonableness and transparency of fees and expenses, the simple idea that investor knowledge of fees and expenses is important and or essential, again may seem so straightforward and basic that you can say, well, why do we even want to mention it? Well, in this case, I think the key reason that we want to mention it is that that the research and our practical experiences anecdotally demonstrate that there's a wide group of clients, investing clients, that don't have a clue what they're paying in fees and expenses, and that in and of itself should be considered outstanding in a very negative way. The fact that across most demographic groups, there are so many investors that don't really know what they are paying, and in the sense that they don't know that the level of standard that they are that their broker or advisor is providing, they don't know what they're getting for what they're paying. So that's another area which we focus on in the paper, and in the last area is the area of clear and complete and truthful communications. I think that any sort of independent view of how a lot of communication is crafted and completed in this arena, it is not nearly as clear, it's not nearly as complete, and it's not clearly nearly as accurate as it should be. And in most other realms, investors or consumers expect and demand. So, in conclusion, in terms of putting a sharper point on why these very straightforward, very simple principles need to be restated and emphasized, I think it really gets down to that when we look at what is being espoused on the brokerage side from the brokerage lobbyists who are aggressively opposing and so far fairly successfully expansion of fiduciary duties on a regulatory level, these principles that seem so obvious and straightforward simply are not being acknowledged or adhered to in terms of what the advocates and the lobbyists are fighting for in the regulatory scheme, and that piece of the picture is in large part what gives significance to these fiduciary best practice principles, and why we believe they need to be restated as the basis for concrete practices that should define what it means to be a fiduciary advisor. So, with that introduction, I will hand the mic over to Blaine, and let Blaine continue regarding FI360 prudent practices. Blaine?
Thank you, Knut. Well, the place I'd like to start is just to try and differentiate what we mean by best practices. So I would suggest that there's probably, we could differentiate best practice as being ways of doing things that meet a higher standard than what's commonplace or even required in many cases. So you might think of this as fiduciary excellence. And I would contrast that with acceptable practices, which I would use that term to describe those that are generally recognized as being compliant with the law or regulations or even professional standards of conduct. And then we might have a third category, which would be common practices, that represent frequently observed behaviors that may or may not actually be acceptable from the standpoint of meeting the law, regulation, or professional standards. And so I think what we can say here is that something we all share in our views is that advice is fundamentally a fiduciary function, and that people who provide personalized advice or exercise discretion over investor assets, they must be held accountable to a higher fiduciary standard. Because there is where we have issues of reliance and control, and I think the Institute's white paper does a very good job of reflecting the importance of that in history and how society has depended on fiduciary conduct. And I, as Knut referenced, those fundamental duties of loyalty and care, I mean, we can largely look at those duties as framing the whole question of compliance. And I think as Chris brought out, it's very much a principles versus the rules sort of idea. And one of the great things about the fiduciary standard is it evolves according to changing circumstances. So, you know, in light of the fact that, you know, if everyone was all the way there to having a complete appreciation for the fiduciary standard, we could stop at the principles level and evaluate each decision that's made in the context of how well did the actions of the fiduciary do in fulfilling those duties of loyalty and care. But over the course of time, and this again is something Chris said on, is that laws and regulations have come along to define the current standards established in for the fiduciary standard. And we know that there are differences in the strength and points of emphasis among the major fiduciary laws, whether that's ERISA under the DOL's purview or Investment Advisors Act under the SEC's purview or state laws. But as I said, it's a principles-driven system that evolves and gets further definition over the course of time through the application of these laws. So just to kind of give a thumbnail sketch of what FI360 tried to do, you know, more than a decade ago, FI360 issued a series of handbooks for investment stewards like plan sponsors or trustees and investment advisors and investment managers, and the intent there was to capture from law and regulation practices that define what is required of investment fiduciaries. And those handbooks have been updated multiple times, including new editions that were just released this last year. Each practice is described in detail, and the legal substantiation is provided for further reference. But in terms of kind of distinguishing where the handbooks and the work of FI360 have gone from what the Institute has put out in the excellent white paper that came out today, you know, the emphasis that we've had has been on putting together the practices that reflect the acceptable or required conduct as required under law and regulation. And the narrative in the handbooks goes a bit more to the best practices level and what best practice behavior would be. But I think where the Institute's work in this white paper and where we're headed overall really focuses heavily on that best practices realm. So, you know, in the process of putting together the practices in the handbooks, I mean, we engaged the specialized law firms who deal in the specific areas of law that I mentioned, and also engaged the Personal Financial Planning Division of the AICPA to do technical editing on the practices. I certainly won't go into it, but you know, the effort there was to try to take the detail so people know what falls on the right side of the regulations and the laws, and also gets a sense of fiduciary best practices towards fiduciary excellence. And those practices are available out there for any interested party to review at the FI360.com website. There is a tab on the homepage there, Prudent Investment Process, the tab that would take you right to those practices if you're interested. But I'll stop there, Knut, and just leave it there with the the connection between what we've done and the viable work of the Institute.
Thank you, Blaine. Then finally, our final speaker is James Watkins. Before James begins, let me ask again if people, if anybody has questions, to send them to me at kar@rpjadvisors.com. Thank you. James?
Thanks, Knut. A fiduciary's duties are the highest known to the law. Whenever there's a legal decision involving fiduciary issues or an article discussing fiduciary issues, more likely than not, the decision or article will include that famous quote. The rationale for the quote is that fiduciary relationships are based largely on trust in the fiduciary. In describing a fiduciary's duties, the key concept is best interest of the client. One of a fiduciary's primary duties is the duty of loyalty, the duty of a fiduciary to always put a client's interest first, to act solely and exclusively in promoting and protecting a client's best interest. As Knut mentioned, one of the key issues with regard to the fiduciary of duty of loyalty involves situations where a conflict of interest may arise between a fiduciary's best interest and those of their client. In today's financial services industry, it is common to see situations where a financial advisor is duly registered as both a stockbroker and an investment advisory representative of an RIA firm. Knut and I recently discussed a key case which noted that such situations naturally result in conflicting interests and must be properly resolved in accordance with existing laws and regulations. In resolving such situations, a fiduciary must do so in a manner that is consistent with a fiduciary's duty of prudence. ERISA provides a good framework for assessing a fiduciary's compliance and obligations with regard to their duty of prudence. ERISA describes prudence as acting with the skill, care, and diligence under the circumstances then prevailing that a prudent man acting in a like capacity and familiar such matters would use in the conduct of an enterprise of a like character and with such aims. Okay, that being said, we can simplify that by looking at three consistent themes on prudence that run throughout ERISA. The first being avoidance of excessive and or unnecessary fees and expenses. Second, recommending and managing investments in such a way as to minimize the risk of significant losses. And finally, making full and fair disclosure to plan participants of all material information. Whenever I discuss and reference those points and discuss these issues with people in the financial services industry, the question is always, what does that have to do with the Institute's best practices initiative? Many financial advisors dismiss the whole issue of fiduciary duties, claiming that they are not fiduciaries. Many financial advisors mistakenly believe that there's really only three ways they can be held liable as a fiduciary and to fiduciary standards. The first is to voluntarily agree to assume such responsibilities. The second, if they manage client accounts on a discretionary basis. Lastly, if they act as an investment advisor under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. What many financial advisors are unaware of is that the courts have recently shown an increasing willingness to impose fiduciary status on them and all the corresponding duties that go with such status, even on purely non-discretionary accounts. The announced threshold for imposing such fiduciary status on financial advisors by the courts is whether a client has the experience, knowledge, and understanding to independently evaluate and understand their financial advisor's recommendations and to reject those that are unsuitable. I'm a trial and securities attorney, and I'm a fiduciary attorney, and I would tell you that based upon my experience, I would suggest that there are a significant number of accounts out there that would cause financial advisors to be thrust into the position and held to a liability standard as a fiduciary. If one looks at the Institute's new best practices that were just announced in today's white paper, if they look at those initiatives objectively, a legitimate argument can be made that the development by the Institute of a set of best practices will promote a win-win situation for both the investing public and the financial services industry. The public would know what conduct they can reasonably expect from their financial advisor, while financial service professionals would have guidelines to help them avoid unnecessary liability. That's all enough.
Thank you, James. And thank Chris and Blaine for your opening remarks as well. I've got a couple of questions that have come in. I hope to get some more. But first, I just wonder, among the speakers, are there any questions that come up that you'd like to direct to another speaker based on what you heard, sort of right off the bat? And if not, I will go to the first couple of questions that we have here coming in. Question, are we fully utilizing the power of social media to fully develop and share these concepts? Where is that PR effort on behalf of the public interest? This is a compelling social issue. It's no longer such a simple financial issue. Any thoughts on that? It's not directed to anybody in particular. Blaine, any thoughts?
I think there is certainly increasing discussion in not only within the profession itself, the advisory profession itself. I mean, we've certainly seen the financial members of the Financial Planning Coalition escalate this, the CFP Board, the CFA Institute, Investment Advisors Association, all of which are pretty active about getting behind the fiduciary standard out there. The work of the Institute, and Knut, as you know, is a member of the Committee for the Fiduciary Standard, one of the original members there. The committee has also attempted to raise public level awareness, which is certainly on the upswing. We've got more and more conversation in the popular press. So I think that's all helpful. Knut, you could probably speak to what's going on at the Institute level. The committee continues to try and use social media, although as an all-volunteer effort, I will say that is more limited. But, I think the call that you made earlier, Knut, for everyone who is behind this, the fiduciary movement, to do more in terms of kind of making this a grassroots effort.
All right. Thank you, Blaine.
I guess the only thing, this is Chris Knut, the only thing that I would add is that I do think that really that is going to be the fuel to get this issue escalated, because it's at least my perception that what has been the regulatory response and or the legislative response is that we something bad happens. We create a piece of legislation to now police it, and we pile lots of regulations on top of it. And then there seems to be kind of a political message that follows with, okay, we've taken care of the problem. It's safe to go back in the water, public, go ahead. And at least from my perspective, I wish that the traction on what the real issues are and promoting the fiduciary duty and creating something more of a, again, to harken back to some of the original intent, the notion of caveat emptor, which is that rather than telling everyone it's safe to get back in the water, that perhaps what we should be telling everyone is to be looking out for these things, and maybe the fiduciary standards that we can come up with and practices can become a bit of a litmus test for people in the future.
Thank you, Chris. Well said. I've got a question for the other three speakers, and it really entails in light of what we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years regarding the response of the crisis from the different regulators. And wondering whether the professional membership groups themselves need to be more active in setting out what it is that is different about a fiduciary advisor, and really be more aggressive, I think, than what we've seen, and you know, being more proactive. And you know, for example, you know, is there a place for the independent membership groups to comment on what is happening on Wall Street and some of the bad examples, some of the examples of bad behavior, for example? I'm just curious the views of the other speakers on that one. Whether you think that's appropriate or not, any thoughts?
Canute,
go ahead.
Well, just quickly, and I will disclose that I'm a member of the CFP board, so don't want to speak on behalf of the board, but I would say that I do think that the CFP board, the CFA Institute, the Investment Advisors Association, CIMA, these are organizations that I do think are working internally to what I would call raise the ethical maturity level of professionals. And I think that's what really, that's a way I would characterize part of what the Institute's doing here in saying that it's not just a matter of figuring out where the line between fiduciary and non-fiduciary is and staying on the right side of the line. It's really to take a deeper look at the philosophy and importance of fiduciary conduct as professionals. So I think there is a lot of activity that's done internally. I think any of the organizations that I mentioned could do more in terms of being vocal. They're all involved in advocacy. I would put out there, for example, David Titsworth's work at the Investment Advisors Association as being particularly noteworthy, along with the Financial Planning Coalition. But in terms of commenting on bad behavior, I think that's probably a bit more difficult, because I think what we want to do is lift the profession internally, rely less on regulatory change, because I'm not sure we're going to see everything that we want as rapidly as we'd want. But I do think there's some positive developments there.
Thank you. James, were you going to say something?
Well, he said basically what I was going to say, and with regard to the I too am a certified financial planner professional, and I know that they are part of the Coalition for Financial Planning, which is being very active in Washington, making presentations and trying to lobby with regard to raising the consciousness and trying to address some of the issues that all of us are trying to address in promoting an adoption by the Department of Labor and the SEC of a uniform fiduciary standard.
All right.
I guess the only thing I would add, Knut, this is Chris, is at least in one part, the CFA Institute is actively promoting at this point a pillar of name and shame. So they do actually see some usefulness in pointing out bad behaviors and in public, and I think it all gets back to, again, and I apologize for being the broken record here, but back to the almost the original intent, which was, you know, that shining a light on things kind of in transparency is one way to really remedy a lot of these issues.
Thank you, Chris, for mentioning CFA Institute. Because I think they deserve a special mention in terms of being aggressively and boldly willing to talk about, as you say, name and shame and what it means to be trustworthy. And this is where I sort of relate this issue to, and why the internal discussions and the internal efforts, which Blaine specifically mentioned by a number of these organizations, they're obviously important, but they're separate and sort of totally, not directly related to what is it that the public sees regarding financial services, financial advice, and what is that picture that they see, and how are we dealing with it? And I think from an organizational point of view, the only group that has made this a priority, it seems, is CFA Institute, and this goes back to the last question. That's where I think that we, as a group of groups, have just simply fallen short in terms of taking this conversation that we're having within the groups or inside Washington to a far broader audience, and re-engineering the conversation so it's accessible to a far wider audience, because the internal conversation and language simply is inaccessible, and that that's where I see some of the threatening clouds out there in terms of so far not a concerted effort to create a conversation that is on our terms and not on the terms of the lobbyists for the brokerage side. And I'm very specific in sort of referring to the lobbyists of the brokerage side, because I know absolutely positively there are a lot of very good brokers who I think are aghast at what they see being said on their behalf by their lobbyists, and they should be aghast. The problem is that they don't, for obvious reasons, say so publicly, and that's where I think we fall down. That's where when you start looking at the issue of trust and trustworthiness, I think that we have been in some part responsible for what we have today in terms of the nature of the problem out there, in terms of investors and how they generally review advice and what we're doing. So anyway, any comment on that comment? I guess not. Okay. Do we have any questions from any of the other speakers? At this point.
Kenneth, I'd like to back up for a moment about the name and shame sort of an approach, and I do think that brings up an excellent point about the role of the professional organizations in having strong codes of ethic, standards of professional conduct, and having strong disciplinary procedures to hold those who breach those responsibilities accountable. And so I do think that there is increasing emphasis in that area, and that certainly helps to elevate the conversation further. But I do like the whole idea of bringing these issues more into the mainstream. But one of the areas of focus that we certainly spend the time on is to say the fiduciary standard, if you really look closely at it, is not only the best approach to take from an investor's standpoint, but ultimately for sustainable business reasons, there's awfully good reason to follow the fiduciary standard as well. And so if we can get to elevate the conversation to more ethical maturity, I would say, in the profession, that there is a business dimension that, to me, can be used to work positively in favor of alignment with investors' interests. And I think the industry has been lax in making that point well known, or trying to make the opposite argument to say that the price of fiduciary principles is too high. I think that in and of itself is kind of repugnant, frankly, whenever you think about putting a price on the principles.
Well, If anybody else wants to come on in, please do. But I think you're absolutely right, Blaine. And you know, and to take that to the next step is where the lobbyists have taken in Washington by persuading apparently many lawmakers that it's not just a matter that fiduciary duties aren't needed, but they go to the next step and they're talking about how harmful they are to investors, and that is a part of the argument inside the Beltway that has taken hold, and we have not done nearly as good a job as we should in responding to that, and you know, calling a spade in ways that might get the point across, because that argument is taking hold in some quarters. Fiduciary duties are harmful to investors, and think about the implications of that on a number of different levels.
This is Jim. I do want to say something based on what you just said. I couldn't agree with you more, and maybe this is the attorney in me, but I keep seeing this continual campaign of misinformation addressing exactly what you said, to fear threatening that there won't be sufficient services for certain segments. And, you know, they're basically playing with house money. Whenever somebody writes an article, somebody calls me and asks me about that, and I tell them that if we were strictly in a court of law, all of that is speculation. And having been, so either prove it or be quiet. And then the other issue is that I've worked in that segment. I've been a compliance officer in the financial services industry. And that argument that there will be less help for IRAs and retirement plans, common sense tells you, and I can tell you from having worked there, I don't know many brokers who are honest that are going to walk away from, you know, pretty much guaranteed money.
Well, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. Okay. Any other comments? I've not gone in any other questions. Are there any other reporters on the line that would like to ask a question at this point? Please pipe in. All right. Well, it looks like that we have come to a close here. Are there any closing thoughts from any of the speakers?
Canute, if I may, it's Blaine. I like the point you made about there being many ethical and competent, talented brokers. And that, in my observations, has been one of the driving forces behind change that is happening at a number of traditional brokerage-type firms. And likewise, I would say that there are firms out there that are now exercising leadership in this area, and we start to see more and more of that. And I know the institution is supported by a number of firms that have really tried to take a leadership role in this area. So despite the fact that I think regulation is stymied in a lot of areas, I do see some very positive developments and greater awareness, and so I'm actually somewhat optimistic that we're the work of having the fiduciary standard much more broadly accepted lies ahead.
Well, good. James, Chris, any final remark? We can just conclude on that high note. But I don't want to cut either of you two off.
I'm fine.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, thank you, Blaine. Thank you, James. Thank you, Chris. And thank you for all those that were online to join us in this conversation. It will continue. I can assure you of that. And So that is, I think that's the close of our call.
Thank you, Knut.
Thank you.